You're listening to Reading Writers, a podcast on the joy of reading widely.
Welcome to Reading Writers. I'm Aaron, and today I'm pleased to bring you part two of a conversation with Barnabas Piper, author of the newly released The Curious Christian, How Discovering Wonder Enriches Every Part of Life. Last week, we discussed the role of curiosity in the Christian life, and today, we're continuing down that line of thought as we look at what Barnabas is reading and he shares his feelings about Shakespeare.
You talked a little bit about, you know, encouraging people read, you know, read broadly. That's the whole theme of the podcast, right?
Right.
Is think differently about how you read so you can enjoy the world a little more. And now, what are you reading right now?
Well, at any given time, I'm usually reading four or five books, partly because I'd like to take my own advice and read broadly, and probably because I never know what I'm going to be in the mood for, so I need to give myself kind of a buffet of options. Yep. I don't understand people who can sit down and just mow through one book at a time. You know, they read like 50 books, 70 books a year, but one at a time. That's insane. It's an amazing gift or something, but I can't do it. So currently, I'm reading four different books that I can remember. There might be one or two that I can't. The first one is called The Originals by Adam Grant. And it's a book about people with original ideas, the birth of original ideas, how do those ideas come to pass? Like the chapter I just finished reading, I'm only about maybe 20, 25% of the way through it. So I can't tell you if it's an amazing book, but so far, very impressed. But he used the example of how Seinfeld got put on TV as an original idea because it was so different than any other sitcom and how the people who were most familiar with sitcoms all thought it was going to be terrible. And the reason it got made was because somebody who had the right points of connection to the industry but had worked mostly in variety shows and late night television and different things but was totally comfortable with offbeat ideas was the advocate for it who got the thing pushed through. So it's things like that. So as somebody who's writing, who is, and then in marketing, like original ideas matter very much to me because doing the same thing everybody else does is lame and doesn't, it's not very effective. It's not a good way to communicate. So that one, this is a book that has stood out to me. I have another one. I don't remember the name of it because it's some generic name for a collection of poetry. So it's like 1,000 poems. It's a huge book.
Yeah.
Just kind of a survey of American and British poetry organized by category. So poetry is something that I've always been intimidated by because I feel like, you know, you get like some beret wearing expert type who's like, oh, that's not very good poetry. And I'm like, I don't know what's good poetry. Like, what if I like Dr. Seuss? Is that bad poetry? Or like, what about like Shel Silverstein? Is that bad poetry? Like, I don't know. And I've always been kind of afraid to delve into it until I had a conversation with my dad and with another couple friends. And they were just like, just read what you like. If you don't like it, go read something else. So, oh, it's that simple. So I just decided to try. And so I just sort of poke through this thing and read probably every third poem because it looks like one I might like. And some of them I think are amazing. You know, I tend to, so far I've connected, like I think Emily Dickinson's poetry is really good, at least the four or five that I have run across. I think Longfellow is okay. And then I think Shakespeare is abysmal and I can't read him poetry wise.
Yeah.
And again, somebody's going to be offended by that. But the point is not that he's actually terrible. It's that I just don't connect with him.
Right.
But so this has been a thing that I wanted to get into because I think poets are incredible. To be able to express as much as they do in the form that they do is an incredible thing. And that's if I can learn that gift of words, then hone my writing in a more poetic fashion, that's why I'm reading this.
Yeah.
And then just to connect with it as well. So then I'm reading The Letters of C.S. Lewis, Volume 1. So it's his early years, like going back to when he was 6 and 7 years old. And they transcribe it as he wrote it. So like the 7-year-old spelling of things, which is really funny.
That's cool.
It's really funny. And he misspells a bunch of words, but he also has a better vocabulary at 8 and 9 than I do at 34. So, yeah. And that's just, I've read almost everything Lewis has written over the years. And my favorite book that I've ever read is Letters to Children. And it's a selection and it's a short book. And so this one, I was like, what about letters from when he was a child? So I figured I'd read that one. And then the last one is The Big Short by Michael Lewis. So Michael Lewis wrote Moneyball. That's probably what he's best known for. But he is probably the best nonfiction true life storyteller that I know of. So The Big Short is about the financial collapse, the Wall Street collapse, when the housing bubble burst in 2008, and the kind of the key players on both sides of it. So that the villains and then all the people who played the villains to make or who not conned them, but saw what was coming and figured out how to short the market to make money. And the best thing about this is I don't know anything about finance. I don't know anything about investing. I don't know anything about Wall Street. And he does a good job of taking incredibly complex and intricate things and basically saying, here's what you need to know. Mm-hmm. This happens when this happens. And when these things happen, this happens, which leads to this outcome. And you go, okay, I can follow those dot to dots. So does a great job with that. So that's one that I'm reading partly just, and again, just kind of fascination by one of the most significant things that's happened in my lifetime, which is this Wall Street downturn that ruined many people and made other people rich and kind of shaped a lot of things about our country. So,
yep.
And Lewis is brilliant. So,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I've been on that note, I mentioned before we started that I've been actually listening to The Fellowship, biographical sketches of the relationship between the Inklings.
Right.
And it's been fascinating to get this, really get beyond the Lewis that most of us think of.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We think of, you know, the man who wrote these wonderful stories for children.
Overrated stories for children. Sorry. We can maybe that's a debate for another time, but
that's all right. You are not the first one, so let's go.
I think Lewis's fiction. I think Lewis's fiction is held in as high esteem as it is because of how overtly Christian it is, not because of how artistically genius it is.
Okay.
In reading, I mean, so I've read The Chronicles of Narnia multiple times, and my impression, more and more, the older I get, and the more times I read them, is that it's a lot of droning with a paragraph of transcendent brilliance like every three pages. And it's just, they're just not great stories. They're okay. Yeah. But I have read, I mean, there's a lot of stories out there that I'm like, that was way more enjoyable just as a pure story.
Yeah.
Harry Potter, the series, so much better as a set of stories than The Chronicles of Narnia. Yeah. Stone me if you'd like, but I stand by that opinion.
Well, we are working for an SBC organization, so that, you know, someone might be protesting after this.
It's all right. But, all publicity is good publicity.
That's right. That's right.
That's what we go with.
That's what we have to. No, but I mean, you're not the first person to make that comparison. I mean, Andy Nasella, he made the point that the reason that he thinks the Potter books are better than the Narnia is actually because Rowling had the end in mind from the beginning, where there's this seeming to be this more of a meandering toward where he's eventually going to go with Narnia. I don't know what you think about that.
Nasella is a higher thinker than I am. He's pretty brilliant. I can see that as I look at it. I think the character development, I mean, if you're just looking at basic elements of story, like characters you empathize with, none of the characters in the Chronicles of Narnia are human. They play a role in actions. Like, you don't know, the Pevensey children are not empathetic characters. They're just people with names. They're four British children who got stuck in this place.
Right.
Whereas, like, Harry, Ron, Hermione, and even some of the side characters, you know, you got Draco Malfoy, like, all of them are empathetic characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know their backstory. You learn things about them, and it's revealed bit by bit as you go. So you want to be them. You want to be their friend. Like, you want to be in that world. Like, Narnia does not make me want to be in that world. It's just sort of, it feels sci-fi-ish to me.
Okay.
It's sort of a distant thing. By the way, Lewis's sci-fi stuff, also not a big fan. It's too aggressively allegorical as well. I think stories are best when they allude to things and they are indicative of things, not when they tell you what to think. And the Chronicles of Narnia very much tell you what to think. Again, this is not saying they're lousy.
No.
It's just saying they get praised as like these epic stories, and I think most of that is because Christians like to hang our hats on things that are Christian. You know, it's the same reason why when Chance the Rapper gets up at the Grammys and starts, you know, samples a Chris Tomlin song, everybody loses their mind. Just like, oh, a Christian artist. Maybe. I mean, I don't know the guy.
Yeah.
I think he's phenomenal. But he's phenomenal because he's phenomenal, not because he's a Christian.
Right.
And that's where Christians go wrong. And I feel like we've applied the same logic to the Chronicles of Narnia. Instead of just being like, they are they are critically brilliant stories or not.
Yeah.
Rant over.
No, it's okay. That's okay.
Have you ever had somebody compare Chance the Rapper to C.S. Lewis?
Not even once. Good. So well done.
Boom.
There we go. We got a first here.
Yes.
But so going back to the Fellowship, I think the thing that's interesting is getting more of a sense of who this guy was beyond the, you know, the lay theologian Christian philosopher that we get in his, you know, in his nonfiction and in his fiction writing as well.
Yeah.
To see, okay, this is the mess that this guy was.
Yeah.
Because
a self-proclaimed hot mess.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. His relationship with Mrs. Moore was messed up.
It was an odd one.
It was unusual.
And there's very little that's been explicitly written about it. There's just a lot of things that make people wonder.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. It's like they're so... It incites curiosity in the wrong kind of way.
Yeah, voyeuristic curiosity. Yeah. Which is sort of a bastardized version of curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, curiosity as portrayed by the fall. Where we want to know things we ought not to know. We want to have a power that's not ours. And I mean...
Yeah,
that curiosity is the one that led Adam and Eve to eat the fruit.
So. Absolutely, absolutely. So, so on that note, do you have any final encouragement for people? Things that have not yet been said.
Well, I think it's going to tie into the me talking about Harry Potter and different things like that, or Chance the Rapper. These are things that people will have very split judgments on. Some people will be like heinously evil. Other people will be like brilliantly amazing. And that's a matter of judgment. So I would not fall on the heinously evil side. However, if somebody chose to take issue with that, they're not comfortable with the amount of magic, they're not comfortable with, you know, the culture of hip-hop or Chance's language or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. What I would simply ask of Christians is to make their own determinations and do their own homework. I am frustrated, to put it mildly, with people who are looking for the shortcut to making a decision. So here's an example. There is a lady named Alyssa Wilkinson who does film review. She did it for Christianity Today for a long time. And I think she's with...
She was Vox.
Is it Vox?
Yeah, she's with Vox.
So committed Christian, but writing film reviews of, you know, just Hollywood films in general. Does a fantastic job. And she told a story on a podcast I heard recently. I think it was with... Might have been Mike Cosper's podcast, Cultivated. And she talked about how she gave a positive review to what I think was a Martin Scorsese film. She basically was like, excellent film. And she got this scathing response a while later from a mother who's like, I took my kids to that film based on your recommendation. And she's like, I didn't recommend it to your kids. I recommended it just sort of artistically, categorically, what kind of a movie it was. And so, but we get the same thing in reading and things like that, where people are like, do you recommend this book? No.
Yeah.
I don't recommend any book to anybody.
Right.
Unless, that's not exactly true. There are a few that I will, but there's not a blanket recommendation in general. It is a, here's what's good about this book. Now do your homework to see if it's good for you. I'm not going to tell you whether or not your 10-year-old should read Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Mine does. But that's because I made it a judgment call that that's right for my child. It might not be for yours. It might give them nightmares or whatever. So do your homework to determine what's good or not, because it's not a black and white thing. And this, again, ties back into curiosity, because it takes a curious mind to say, I'm going to go figure out what this thing is instead of just taking the, like, whatever is handed to me and like, well, Christian leader said it was good. You can't put your curiosity in the hands of somebody else or your children's or anything like that. So do your homework, apply your curiosity to any field of art, you know, film, music, books, and don't just absorb a recommendation.
All right, listeners, you can find some links to a few of the books that we've talked about, including Barnabas's new one on my blog, blogingtheologically.com. You probably won't get them easily in the show notes if you're on iTunes, so sorry about that. Barnabas, thanks so much for doing this. This was great.
Oh, I love this. I can talk books and reading with another fellow book and reading lover all day long. So thanks so much for having me on.
No problem. Now, here's one thing before we go. It's a question that just came to mind.
All right.
What is a type of book that you have not yet read but have been curious to try?
Oh, a type of book I have not yet read.
So not necessarily, so that can go beyond genre.
Right. That's a good question. I think I've read almost every type of book at least once,
mm-hmm.
like by genre.
Yeah.
I don't read very many autobiographies
mm-hmm.
or memoirs
mm-hmm.
because that is one that I would like to find really, really good ones, especially memoirs, because those mm-hmm. are a little different things.
Yeah.
But memoirs are either phenomenal or horrific.
Yes.
There's almost no middle ground.
Yep.
And so that's why I don't read them, because it's, you know, the risk is too great for my time. But that is one where, but a brilliant memoir is one of the best kinds of books. And so that's one that I look at and I go, if I could find a few more like transcendently brilliant memoirs, I would like to read more of those.
Yeah. Perfect. Cool. Well, I'm trying to think of a good one that I've read. I like pop memoirs. Like they're just silly and goofy.
Yeah, because they're not trying to be anything other than just sort of like reflections on an industry or a life spent in film or whatever. One really good one, I'll plug a fellow author and a friend, a guy named Russ Ramsey.
Mm-hmm.
So Russ Ramsey wrote Behold the King, he wrote Behold the Lamb of God. The book.
Yep.
Behold the King of Glory, Behold the Lamb of God. He has one coming out called Struck,
mm-hmm.
and it's a memoir on suffering and facing death. But like every good memoir, it's not about his story. It's about the themes that his story represents. So, you know, in my life, the hard things that I have been through, it's not heart failure, but the themes are exact. I read it and I could read myself into it so easily, and his insights and his vulnerability and his experience. And he's a brilliant, he can tell a narrative so well. So Struck by Russ Ramsey is a memoir that I read recently. I got to read it before it was published. Is phenomenal, and your listeners should definitely go look that one up.
Cool. All right. So there's one extra one for us.
There you go.
All right. Thanks again, Barnabas.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to part two of Aaron's discussion with Barnabas Piper on Reading Writers. Tune in next time as Aaron is joined by Trevin Wax to discuss Christians and cultural engagement and their shared appreciation of G.K. Chesterton. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a rating and review on iTunes. Your feedback helps more people find the show. You can find Aaron on Twitter at Aaron Strongarm. And for more content, including reading recommendations, please visit bloggingtheologically.com.